Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 117 of the Writership Podcast.
Today, we're talking about shoe leather. I'm Leslie Watts, here with Jari Bolander, author of The Entrepreneur Ethos and StoryGrid editor. To learn more about the podcast, visit writership.com/podcast.
As you know, the podcast is sponsored by Jim Kukral from the Author Marketing Club. Jim just launched his new service for authors called Happy Book Reviews. We all know that books with more high-quality reviews sell more copies. HappyBookReviews.com is a service where Jim hopes to bring your book happy with reviews. Check out the options at www.happybookreviews.com because nobody likes a sad book. You can make your book happy with reviews.
Welcome, Jari.
Hey, thanks, Leslie. It's great to be here.
So we, just a reminder for everyone that Clark is taking a break and I'm having some editor friends join me. And Jari is a friend from the StoryGrid training. And we've been doing a lot of StoryGrid type work together.
Yes. Lots of stuff going on and really exciting. And I'm so happy to be here. Thank you once again for inviting me to be a guest host. I really love what you're doing at the Writership, and just I'm looking forward to digging in and having a good time.
Great. And if folks want to find you after the show, where should they go?
Well, I blog at a place called thedailymba.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at thedailymba. And then LinkedIn, Jari Bolander. I have a pretty unique name, so pretty easy to find me online. So yeah, reach out if you have any questions about entrepreneurship or MBA stuff or StoryGrid editing. It's just been a great experience so far, and got to meet great people like you, Leslie, and talk about story and find my tribe of all the story nerds out there. So yes. It's been awesome.
Story nerds of the world unite. awesome. It's so cool to have you here. And I wanted to, I have a couple of reminders before we dive in, is that you can still grab Clark's course, the Advanced Writing with Harry Potter. The place to go for that is thebookeditorshow.com/Potter, and the offer to pay what you want is still available with lots of bonuses. So grab that up if you haven't yet. Then you can get access to the Google spreadsheet with all of the Writership podcast episodes, including the genres and the topics, at www.writership.com/index. And I wanted to mention a little plug for the show notes, because I was responding to one of the authors who submitted, and I said that, let me know if you have any questions, because sometimes when I'm explaining things on the podcast, I get going really fast and I might miss a thing or two. And that in the note to the author that's also included in the show notes has a lot more information, and I move through things perhaps a little more systematically when I'm not, recording. So if you, for a more complete explanation of the concepts, and if you have questions, you can stop by the website and check out the show notes at writership.com/episodes. So, Jari, do you have a quote for us this week?
I do, actually, and I thought of this quote when I read the piece that we're going to talk about a little later. It's from Abraham Lincoln, It's his first inaugural address. It's actually the last part of it. I think it's perfectly captures what we're going to talk about following. So here goes. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Through passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic chords of memory will swell when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. And that just seemed the perfect quote to begin the discussion of the piece today. And also, I think we could learn a lot from Abraham Lincoln in the time that he was in is very similar to the times that we live in now. And, you know, the times that we'll talk about soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great. So our submission for today is, it's called The Homefront, and it's by Melinda McDonald. And we have a women's society and historical piece. And we'll talk a little bit about what that is when we discuss it. The word count is almost 92,000. And we've got the beginning, and there's a miscarriage that's described in the submission. And so if that is difficult for you, then you might want to avoid this one. Okay, so without further ado, Jari is going to read The Homefront.
Wonderful. So The Homefront by Melinda McDonald. Chapter 1. Detroit, 1941. We lived in a trailer when we first arrived. We had come from Collinsville, Illinois, to Detroit, where Ollie was guaranteed a job at Ford Motor Plant as a pattern maker. A lot of young people were in the city then, shooting for their dreams. We were young, newlywed, and optimistic. This was our new life, away from the depression in southern Illinois, where there were no jobs and people lived on farms and ate sugar on bread for a treat. But the move didn't go quite as planned. After we lived in the trailer for a while, we traded with another couple for their apartment and furniture. They wanted to travel and we wanted to start a family. It was pretty exciting, and it got more exciting when I found out I was expecting. I didn't tell Ollie, though. I was going to surprise him. We'd been in Detroit for 3 months, and I didn't have a job. It felt kind of funny because I had always worked ever since I graduated from high school back in Litchfield. I met Ollie when I first worked at my first job for Montgomery Ward. He was a good-looking guy, black hair and blue eyes, and a way of talking that beguiled everyone in his path. He was a salesman for a tool company, but I bet he could sell anything. I felt lucky to land such a prize. We got married 6 months after we met. But when moved to Detroit and everything changed, the day went by slowly. You can only do so much housework. The only saving grace was my dog, Sandy, a mutt who looked a lot like Orphan Annie's dog in the comics. Growing up, I'd always been around dogs. Our family, which consisted of my younger sister and mother, had a sheepdog and then a mutt. We all loved dogs, and I swore I would never live without one. Detroit was a big city, and I was a little bit nonplussed by it. I never lived in a city larger than 5,000 people, and Detroit was way bigger than that. Over the years, the city had become a hotbed for new technology, and several automobile plants had opened up. Ford, Chrysler, General Motors, the list goes on. We weren't the only new folks in town either. People were flooding in, looking for the jobs that they had been told were here. And they were. But having so many new people in town created a strange, unsettling atmosphere. It was almost like a boom town, and anything went. I found the whole thing very uncomfortable. It was a December night in 1941, shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the entry of the U.S. into what came to be known as World War II. The nation was in the grip of anti-Japanese terror, afraid that another attack might happen on the mainland. To top it all off, Ollie was drunk again, something he did with increasing frequency. He spent most evenings out drinking with his friends after work, and that night was no exception. I remember it well. It was a Friday. And so I was pretty sure that I would call to say that he was going out. He did. About 5 p.m., Ollie called. "Hey, Dot, you sweet little thing." He was always trying to butter me up, but it wasn't going to work this time. I steeled myself, the better to resist his charm. "I'm going to meet some of the gang down at Biggie's. Want to join us?" Of course I didn't. I wasn't crazy about drinking, and besides, I was expecting, and didn't much feel like it. But I learned long ago that arguing with him was fruitless. "No, I guess not. I'll stay home and see you later." I hung up the phone and realized that I was relieved. Without being aware of it, I began to actively dislike my charming husband. I just couldn't trust him. He was always saying things that weren't true, like he got a promotion when he didn't. I'm not sure why he made up so many things, but it wasn't a good way to start a marriage. "Well, it's just you and me, Sandy, as usual." I roughed the dog's fur and he licked me affectionately. Sometimes it felt like Sandy was the only thing that loved me, and he was just a dog. As I sat down on the sofa, I felt a sharp pain in my lower abdomen. It hurt so bad, and I hunched over and then ran into the bathroom. Blood was pouring down my leg. My first thought, I'm losing the baby. I sat on the toilet sobbing and felt the small life slip out of me. I hadn't been very far along, only a month or so, but it's always been my dream to be a mother, and I felt like my heart would break. Suddenly, the whole thing. The marriage, the move to Detroit, playing house, pretending that we had a good marriage, all seemed pointless. Sandy nosed at my knee, suspecting that something was wrong. I never cried. I just hugged him and cried some more. I don't know how long I sat there crying. Finally, I got up, pinned on a sanitary pad, and staggered into the bedroom. I thought I would lie down and sleep for a while. Sandy followed at a respectful distance. I couldn't sleep, so I got up, pulled my suitcase out from the closet shelf, and began throwing clothes into it. Something had broken inside me, and I had to get out. I decided to catch the first bus home, and home was where Grandma and Lola were, home to Lynchfield, Illinois. Now I was going to figure out a way to take Sandy too. I didn't care what Ollie thought, and I don't think he would think much until morning anyway. His pattern was to come home late on Friday, after an evening of drinking and passing out on the couch. I sat down to rest on the camisole bedspread and looked at myself in the mirror over the dresser. I was petite with dark eyes and wavy hair. No permanent waves for me. I had heard men say that I was a hot little number. I don't know about that, but I know the effect I had on them. Usually they went a little crazy around me. Ollie played hard to get, and that drove me nuts. I remember thinking that I just had to have him. Fat lot of good that did me now. "Come on, Sandy, let's go." The dog followed me obediently, looking up occasionally with his big brown eyes. He was a large animal. His head came up to my waist, and his shaggy fur was golden. Must have had a little retriever in him. I put his leash on him, even though he would never run away. I put on my coat, pinned on my hat, and picked up my suitcase. I didn't bother leaving a note for Ollie. By the time he figured out where I was, I'd be safe at home. And right now, that was all I wanted to do. As Sandy and I walked down the steps and onto the snowy, Detroit evening, I resolved to never look back. I made a mistake in marrying Ollie, but hopefully I was young enough to rebuild my life on firmer footing. Chapter 2, December 1942, outside Springfield, Illinois. As Lola and I sat on the train that went out to the new plant, I remembered the dark trip home from Detroit. I ended up hitchhiking because they wouldn't let Sandy on the bus, and I wouldn't leave him. Rebuffed by the man at the ticket counter, I stood discontently on the curbside. I don't know what to do, but luckily my looks seemed to help me out. A young man asked me if I needed to go somewhere, and I said yes, Lynchfield, Illinois. And could the dog come too? He seemed a little taken aback, and then he said he could give me a ride as far as Muchie, Indiana. And I jumped at the chance to get a ride that far. At Munchie, I lucked into another ride that was going as far as Terre Haute, and Sandy and I somehow made it home in a couple of days. It was pretty obvious that we wouldn't stay in Lynchfield. My grandma, Mildred, bless her soul, at 88, was too old to play hostess, and within a day, I'd collected my sister Lola and set out to find work at the new Sangamon Ordnance Plant. Sandy stayed home with grandma, but just until I could get him. The plant had been running ads in the local town papers, trying to get women to apply for jobs there. Most of the women were married, and their husbands were off fighting in the war. The majority of them had never worked, or if they had, it was in the distant past. They had no income and definitely no sense of themselves as employees. But there was a lot of pent-up demand out there for gainful employment, and plant helped scratch that itch. The Sangamon Ordnance Plant was a huge operation that resulted from the merging of two munition plants in the level farm country just west of Ennolapolis. The plants had combined early in 1942, and at the end of the year, hiring was ramping up. There were thousands of jobs available, but most of the men were off the war, so they were filled by women and older men who were past Army service age. Lola and I were sure that we were going to land a well-paying job at the plant. As we rode the chain through dreary, barren farmland, I imagined myself working on the line, assembling bombs to help our boys overseas. It all sounded incredibly romantic and worthwhile. The dangers seemed non-existent. The glamour of the job was what I was after. I looked at my sister, who was nodding off. Lola had always been a looker, with her blonde hair, blue eyes, and curvaceous figure. I nudged her. "Lola, wake up. Aren't you excited about going to work at the munitions plant?" She shook herself awake and gazed at me incomprehensibly, her blue eyes blinking. What? Lola had never been particularly strong in the mental area. But that's what Howie, her husband, who was fighting Nazis in Germany, saw in her. Who knew what brought two people together? The car was crowded with other women going to the plant seeking jobs. As Lola slowly came back into consciousness, the train pulled up into the depot and passengers began to stream out. I could hardly wait my turn to jump from the car. Both Lola and I were wearing our Sunday best. In my case, a red polka dot is shirt waist with a cunning white collar, while Lola wore a green long sleeve number with matching collar. Of course, we had our warm winter coats on, which were pretty nondescript, but were saved by our millinery. I had on my cute red hat with short veil, and she wore a big white topper that looked kind of like a derby with one side pulled up. I must say we looked fine. If it was up to me, I would have hired us with no questions asked. A sign caught my eye as I disembarked. "Employment office this way," with a big arrow. We joined the line of girls that were headed towards the office and shortly arrived at one of the biggest rooms I had ever seen. Men interviewed us quickly, and everyone in front of us seemed to be hired on the spot. Finally, it was my turn. I eagerly told the gentleman about my office experience at Montgomery Ward. The balding man beaded his brows and said, "I think you'll do well in timekeeping. Here's where you'll report on Monday." He handed me a paper with M8 Timehouse and the words bookkeeper/secretary on it. I met up with Lola shortly afterwards, and she was burbling with delight. "I got a job on load line L making fuses." I told her I got a job in timekeeping, but didn't say what I was that I was extremely envious of her job. It seemed like she was in the thick of things where I was on the outskirts. On Monday, Lola was given a blue jumpsuit and told to shower and change into it. Since I was in timekeeping, I didn't have to change. After all, I wasn't going to be working with explosives like she was. Lola had to wear special shoes and couldn't have any metal on her body, not even hairpins. A smoker, Lola wasn't allowed to carry cigarettes or a lighter to her job. They were strict. Even with all these restrictions, Lola babbled continuously about how great her job was going to be. It made me even more envious. As she went off to her job, I trudged over to the M8 Timehouse. I wasn't enthused about this job, and it apparently showed, because when I reported to work, my supervisor, Mr. Bruce, seemed a little stumped. "What's your name, dear?" he said, thoughtfully chewing his pencil. "Dorothy Osborne, Dot for short." I wondered if this would be a better job than I thought. Mr. Bruce reminded me a lot of my old boss, Barry Kirkpatrick. And that wasn't in a good way. However, I decided to give him a chance. "Well, Miss Osborne," he said, looking me up and down, "let's see how good you are at extending time cards." And that's the end of it. And I apologize if I misspelled or mispronounced some of these.
It happens. It happens. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for reading. And thanks to Melinda for sharing her story with us. This is a, you know, we mentioned it's a society piece, women's society and historical society. And it's a great setup, I think, for this. I was like, when I was kind of pulling my thoughts together earlier, I was like, it seems to start in a strategically advantageous place in history, you know, to look at women's role in society and, you know, and historically, which sounds way more technical and boring than I mean it to. But basically, Dot is this great character who's bold enough to walk out on her marriage, but she, you know, she was not sophisticated enough to avoid getting into that mess in the first place. So she's kind of this person who's has, you know, is capable of doing some strong, brave things, but also sometimes gets stuck. And I was thinking that the beauty of historical fiction is that you can present situations that reflect the power, our current power struggles, without having to be on the nose with them. And so you can, you know, you can talk about here, you've got the circumstances of gender, and we don't know it yet, but immigration and wealth, you know, come into it as well. And so I think the similarities and the contrasts to our own time make this a fantastic setup for a society piece.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is one of my favorite parts of U.S. history. I agree with you. I really like the Dot character. I think however she develops through this whole novel is going to be, you know, a real wonderful you know, tribute to that time. And it really is, you know, the greatest generation for a reason. We can always learn a lot from the amount of sacrifice and the astronomical amount of character that generation had. It's, you know, again, it's, you know, this society, women, historical, external genre. You know, my guess is the internal genre will be, you know, Dot having her worldview shifted or having some sort of maturation, because obviously she's already taken that first step by leaving her husband. How she got into that situation, I'm sure, maybe later on in the novel. But again, great, great way to kind of set up the world. And it's really important for these kind of society political novels that the beginning hook sets the world up. Like, you got to know what you're up against. You know, this is done perfectly in Brave New World, for example. If you've ever read that, the way it's described, you kind of understand what you're up against. And I think in this particular case, you know, we would probably need a little more description of the world and sort of the circumstance that Dot has herself or put herself in. But yeah, I mean, really, really a good, I mean, Dot's just a lovely character, and I think she'll make a great hero of her own movie as this thing kind of progresses. So,
yeah. So I want to talk a little more about society novels in general and yeah, what they are and what they're exploring, and so we can get a view of, you know, like, yeah, what are we going to be exploring in this piece? And like you said, you've been working on a story grid edition of Brave New World, yes. Analyzing that, which is a great, I mean, among other things, it explores society.
Yes. Very much so. And what's kind of ironic about this story in Brave New World is the way Brave New World is set up is it's very far in the future. Everything's automated and everyone is sort of like zombies. You know, they're just always trying to be happy. Mm-hmm. And the world is managed for them, and they've got different castes of people. They always reference time is after Ford, which is after Henry Ford. And so it's just interesting because, you know, Henry Ford developed the assembly line and sort of made people commodity. And that's what Huxley was kind of getting at, is that we can't, you know, we have to be very careful that humanity is not a commodity. And so it is kind of interesting that, you know, not too far after Henry Ford built the assembly line and the Model T and whatnot, we're now jumping right into a, you know, 1940s World War II era Greatest Generation story where that amount of productivity is what won the war. I mean, there's no doubt that the major factor in our winning World War II was the U.S. worker could, I mean, crank out whatever the troops needed overseas. So, so when it comes to this society genre, which is what this is, because, you know, you have to, again, the world needs to be defined. Like, again, what's the protagonist up against? So Dot, what is Dot up against in the new world she finds herself in, or not the new world, the existing status quo? So the status quo is, in wartime, men are gone, women are being called upon to work. That's different. That normally didn't happen. I mean, you know, we're talking about the traditional 30s and 40s where, you know, the wife stayed at home with the kids and the husband went off to work. This completely upended in World War II in this time. So it'll be interesting, you know, to see how she, the author, evolves that and says something about society, because it's clearly going to be this is the most important part of the society genre, like defining the world. Now in your mind, you know what everyone's up against, and then as it progresses, then you start to see all sorts of complications and how Dot is going to interact with the world and then hopefully change the world. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. And there's like that part of that world building needs to be like who possesses the power. And we have some hints of that in that Ollie, Dot's husband, had, you know, some power in the relationship because he was the breadwinner. So presumably he was controlling the money. Yes. and that sort of thing. And then we get hints from her boss, or her former boss. And the comparison to her new boss was not that was not a good comparison.
Right.
You know, so we have some hints at it, but it would be good to, you know, develop that further, like you're saying, in the beginning, just to make sure that we know the score, essentially.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and again, the thing that could be, you know, unique or innovative about it is this particular part of the country, there may be some nuance. Or from what she said in the introduction, this was based on a real ammunition plant and real people. Mm-hmm. There could be some unique circumstance that could put a twist on it, could innovate that part of it. So, I mean, I think for those in the modern world, this would be the start of what would be considered the, you know, like the patriarchy, like Dot somehow, some way is going to, you know, battle against the patriarchy. And in, you know, in World War II, that time frame, I mean, the patriarchy, you know, started to crumble, I think would be the word I would use. Because again, all these women are in the workforce and they're like, well, they're doing just as good as men. Why, you know, what's the deal? So yeah, really interesting to see how it's going to turn out.
Yeah. So, we're looking at this as an opening, and we kind of talked about this a little before we started recording, that, you know, that we have the first chapter is about essentially Dot getting excited that she's pregnant, and then having the miscarriage, and then, you know, and Ollie's behavior being the impetus to essentially, you know, she's out of there, she's leaving, like there's nothing to stay for. And then chapter two puts us right some time in the future, so after the war starts, and we have her on the train going to apply for a job here. So I actually found, like, although the information and the, you know, the facts in chapter one are interesting and relevant certainly to Dot's journey, but what I'm wondering is if it's, first of all, if it's a strong enough hook to pull the reader in, you know, if it's specific enough and strong enough, and then also if the story wouldn't start better in chapter two, where she's looking for the job. Like, it's essentially, you know, when you said it was her new world, I know you didn't intend to say that, but to me it feels like there's old world, which is her with Ollie, and then a newer world, which is her starting work at the plant, and then there are the events of this story that, you know, whatever kicks off and upsets her new world.
It's a brand new
world. Did I explain that okay?
Of course you did. Yeah, no, I understood exactly what you're saying. Yeah, no, I agree that chapter two, or, you know, the start of chapter two, would be a better beginning, and the reason is that you know, chapter one has got a really great background of Dot, but I don't think you would want to reveal that right away, because that's sort of her inner strength. That's sort of, you know, I think it would be best done later on, because the wonderful thing about chapter two is, again, you want to define the world and how your protagonist is fitting into it, or complying and then not complying. I mean, that's sort of, again, since I've got Brave New World on my mind, that's kind of how Bernard in Brave New World does it. Bernard's the protagonist in Brave New World. So yeah, it the bones are there. I mean, this is, again, it's just such a wonderful period of history. There's a lot of, you know, interesting things that can, you know, be weaved in. And I think, you know, she's got a really good start on this. I mean, it's again, it's a great part of history. It's got such a lot of great lessons and a lot of really good society type lessons that could be done. But I really do agree with you that, you know, it seems that chapter two would be a better beginning, just because, you know, you don't want to know right away what Dot's about. I mean, you kind of want to leave a little mystery, just because, you know, I know what she was probably trying to do is, I want to feel connected, and I want to feel that Dot overcame something big, and you do feel that in the first chapter, but I think it would hook you in better if you sort of really felt this is the world, and, you know, it's Dot against the world kind of thing, and then, you know, why later on. It would just be a little better of a surprise, I think.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, and it depends. I mean, obviously it depends on what Dot's journey is in this story, right. Because, you know, what we have a description, you know, of what it is, but we don't have the details. So we're kind of guessing how it goes. But it seems to me that, you know, that's not the, you know, that Dot leaving her husband isn't the inciting incident of the entire story.
Right.
And one of the things that's mentioned in the summary that the author shared, I'll just share this real quick, that this story was inspired, as Jari said, by a real woman who worked during World War II at the Sangamon Sangamon ordinance plant. The plant is long gone and the woman is dead, but the plant's ruins and the woman's reminiscences prompted me to write this book. Okay. But then also, oh, where's the part that I'm looking for? This is the part that I was looking for. This is the actual synopsis. So it's 1941. She's gotten a job at the plant near Springfield. She meets a handsome young man, a Lithuanian immigrant named Adam Trinus. I'm not pronouncing that right, probably. Sorry about that. And they fall in love. But all is not as it seems. Dot is trying to hide a dark secret in her past, and Adam is not as perfect as he first appears. With World War II and the dangerous work conditions at the munitions plant in the background, the reader comes in contact with a variety of immigrants. Dot's landlords, the much reviled Japanese Sasakis, Adam's Lithuanian family, and Dot's Jewish co-worker Esther Goldman. So she's got a dark secret, and
yeah,
if that secret is her marriage to, I don't know.
Yeah, so, right.
But if that is the secret, then, you know, we wouldn't want to reveal it to the readers probably in this way. You'd want to, you know, hold that back. Yeah, and it just feels like, what, like, given that synopsis, it feels like the story lies elsewhere, and that the information that's in that chapter one could be revealed more powerfully at a time when it turns a scene, right? When it makes a difference, when it takes her closer to or further from her story goal. And at this point in the story, we don't, you know, she doesn't have, there's not a love interest or, you know, other things that she is interested in that I think will be her ultimate story goal.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, from the synopsis, I mean, it's a great setup for a really, you know, nail biter, interesting twist and turn kind of story. And so, yeah, who knows, maybe chapter one is not Dot's deep dark secret. I don't know. I mean, clearly back then that would have been a pretty dark secret for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's better ways to sort of reveal that. And it just makes it me as the reader want to continue on. And again, you know, the framework is there. This is a very, like, well thought out in terms of, okay, this is how I want to make it work. Mm-hmm. And that synopsis is really great. I mean, that is a fantastic way to kind of set up, okay, this is how this is going to work. So yeah, it's sometimes better to reveal those secrets, like you said, where in places where there's going to be a climax or a twist or a turn that's going to bring Dot closer or farther away from her story, her goal. So yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So when we're looking at the, you know, at the, particularly the first chapter and that, you know, the first scene essentially where Ollie, it has been drinking again and she has a miscarriage and, you know, there was some stuff. And I mentioned, right, in the opening that we were going to be talking about shoe leather. And shoe leather is essentially it's information that's, well, it can be a wide range of things, right? It can be description. It can be backstory. It can be action or dialogue that's not really moving the story forward. And so we have some instances of that. And again, you want to take this, we're coming at this from not having read the entire story. So we're guessing a little bit, but there's some instances where it seems like there's information that the reader doesn't need at this point in the story, and that, you know, is stuff that, you know, like facts that the reader will need to hold. And that's not, yeah, that's not specifically pushing things forward. And you had some great examples of this.
Yeah.
Pulled from the story.
So let me look at the one I think was sort of the best. And you know, to your point about shoe leather, what's really interesting about shoe leather is, you know, when you're writing, especially early drafts, shoe leather is absolutely essential to put in your story.
Yes.
And the reason is because that is your thought on the page. And if you're editing that thought as you write it down, you're going to lose it, and you never want to lose it. So when we talk about shoe leather and taking shoe leather out, what we really mean is farther along in your editorial process. I mean, you know, you will have lots and lots of opportunities to refine and, you know, move stuff around and, you know, make it a little more meaty and impactful. And a lot of the times, shoe leather is basically you are telling what it looks like instead of showing what it looks like. And I know you have a couple of quotes later on what we'll talk about, but let me just tell you a little bit about, in the couple of scenes that I'll talk about right now, how the, I don't know exactly how I'd do it different, but you can kind of tell that you're telling instead of showing. So let me do this one. This one's toward, I think this is in the second chapter.
Okay.
Both Lola and I were wearing our Sunday best. In my case, a red polka dot is shirt waist with a cunning white collar, while Lola wore a green long sleeve number with a matching collar. Of course, we had our warm winter coats on, which were pretty nondescript, but were saved by our millinery. I had on my cute red hat with short veil, and she wore a big white topper that kind of looked like a derby with one side pulled up. I must say we looked fine. If it was up to me, I would have hired us with no questions asked. So that's one example of, you know, the description of the clothing and, you know, how that goes. It doesn't necessarily move the story along as much as if there were something unique about the way they were dressed.
Right.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
And so now what's good is that, right, since this is a historical period piece, a lot of the readers may not know what, you know, those, how they dressed back then. But that doesn't mean that you have to tell them. A lot of the time, showing or having historical reference will give the reader a little more imagination and then move things a little more forward. So not exactly sure how I would rewrite that, but I would say think about how to show with examples as opposed to telling the exact amount. You want the reader's imagination to like visualize Dot and Lola and be like, oh, she looks like, you know, Betty Davis, or, you know, the last year's Betty Davis, blah, 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 you know, just like in, or, you know, just like in Gone with the Wind, you know what I mean? Where it's,
yeah,
you know, it just elicits some imagine, like, wow, oh yeah. So the reader has to really think and be like, oh, I wonder, because that's, again, a little historical cue, more about the culture. Again, great first draft description. It gets you thinking, and you can, you know, like what we always do is go back and, okay, what do I really mean by that? So,
yeah, well, and you know, you make a good point, because there's this tension between you have to provide enough details for the reader to be able to create their own picture, but you don't want to create so many details that you're essentially imposing more than they need, or adding more detail that's not necessary. And that's a tricky thing to do because we have some really lovely, like you said, you know, the description of the clothing is that, like, that's really great. But it's that for me, the real shoe leather would be the conclusions, right? So I think it's good for her to say, like, and this, we're getting really granular here, but it's part, you know, it's part of understanding what works, you know, what's shoe leather and what do you need to provide. So wearing our Sunday best is a good conclusion.
Yes.
Because it tells you, you know, it gives you a definition, essentially. So these clothes equal Sunday best, right?
Right.
And but the I must say we looked fine. And the, you know, our coats were pretty nondescript. Like that kind of thing doesn't as much, you know, like doesn't really tell us something useful. And so like one of the things that I've said about when you're doing this, right, if you're describing a, for example, if you're describing a church, there are certain things that are common to all churches. And then, you know, so you don't need to list all of, you know, you don't need to include or cite those things. The reader can conjure the things that are common to all churches generally. But what you want to point out are the things that are unique to this particular church, and even more refined, the things that this point of view character notices about this particular church. And so you're kind of really zeroing in on what is specifically relevant to the reader. And the and in this paragraph, I would say even that there's a, you know, like some of the detail, like there, the details are almost a, like a police sketch in a way that they're, you know, it's like it's listed, and that the in later drafts, what you'd want to do is weave those details into what they're doing and what they're saying, what the point of view character is noticing about where they are, and all of that. And that is, it's tricky. So I don't want to make that sound like, oh, it's just easy.
Oh no, it's
this
not
is
easy
a great, you know, this is a great draft to have produced. You've got lots of details in there that you'll be able to, you know, pull out where they're not needed and spread throughout the story. And so, yeah, I think that's a really good one. A good example, because it's got good details. You just are going to want to weave them in at appropriate times so that you are, you know, right, setting us down in this lovely world, this lovely, really rich world that you need, you especially need for a society piece.
Yes.
And then, and showing us the character and what she notices, because that'll be important.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all about how the characters are interacting with the world that they're in. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, how that is going to move the story forward. And I agree. I mean, there is a rich set of description in these first two chapters that, you know, they put you in the world, and you just, as you tend to do as you move down in drafts, figure out, okay, is this moving the story forward, or can I say it a different way that's going to conjure in the reader's mind what this character is going through, what they, you know, look like? Because, you know, readers are, a reader of this type of book is going to know a little bit about the history, and he or she reads these particular types of books because they're fascinated by it. So mm-hmm. they are going to be smart, and they are going to know, and you can use that to your advantage. And
mm-hmm.
and I think that's important for a society, in the society genre, to take advantage of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, like in terms of the details and, you know, and what you share and what's shoe leather and what's not. So, right. I mean, again, I want to kind of define that shoe leather is like, it's stuff that you generally don't need. And it can be description or backstory, dialogue, action. It can be a whole scene even,
right,
where characters right. are moving from one place to another, but nothing is changing in terms of where the protagonist is in relation to the wants and needs. And when you want to, you know, obviously, like, in after you get that initial draft down, and thank you so much for saying that up front, because it is important. You're not wanting to start looking at that kind of thing until you have a completed draft of the story. And then, you know, when you're doing revision, you'll want to be identifying these things that are not really, they're not really necessary. But again, you know, you have the tension between presenting the world so that the reader gets what they need and then can conjure the rest of it up within their minds. But you also have instances when you're going to need to essentially plant seeds for things that are going to happen later. And that a certain thing might not seem relevant at, you know, at the time, but will be relevant later. And it's kind of, you know, it's a little bit of information you're slipping in, so that, for example, a gun doesn't just come out of nowhere
right
in a scene right. later. It's like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
So I was thinking, well, let's take Chekhov's gun, for example, right?
Right.
Don't introduce it unless you're going to use it.
Exactly.
Except, you know, red herrings, and there are exceptions. But when you're doing that, when you're seeding for something that happens later, it's good to make it relevant in the scene in which it appears, even if it's, you know, even if your main purpose is, I gotta show that there's, for example, a gun, you know, like a rifle over the mantle, you know, in the living room, then you want to make sure that the POV character notices it, because she's going to need it later, let's say, or see it's missing later, you know, however
yeah.
a story might unfold. But you need to give her a legitimate reason to make note of it. So it might be out of place in the room, or someone else might mention it, or you know, like, have that be something triggers her to make note of it. And then you're essentially using the fact that there's a rifle over the mantle in the living room. You're using that as ammunition, exposition as ammunition, mm-hmm. twice,
right.
essentially,
right.
rather than
right.
just once.
Right. I mean, even that whole description of Dot, or the writer describing the coats they're wearing,
mm-hmm.
That would be a great kind of planting the seed for something later on, where, you know, the coat gets mixed up, or, you know, there's some drama because, you know,
mm-hmm.
they're in wartime. They can't have nice coats. Everyone's coat looks the same. You know what I mean? It's so,
right.
so if that's going to happen, then that's great, because now, like you said, you know, this nondescript coat, that could be a clue later on. Oh,
mm-hmm.
well, something, you know, you don't know, but you could drop these little, you know, clues and stuff. But yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, that's a great example that you just pulled out there. Yeah, the coat being nondescript. That's
yeah.
absolutely, like, that could totally pay off later.
Yeah, right. Right, because these, you know, the beginning hook of these types of books, from what I've been reading and doing, there are a lot of things that are going to come back in the middle build and the ending payoff. There's going to be a lot of things that the reader is going to remember, like, oh yeah, I remember, and you want to set those up. And it could be, you know, hey, there may be some shoe leather in the beginning that you have to keep because it sets up further down the line. It's, you know, it's the thing that's the inciting incident of the middle build, because, you know, in the example I just gave, it could be, oh, you know, Dot picks up the wrong coat and finds that, you know, her, what is it, Romanian boyfriend's a spy or something.
Lithuanian,
I
think.
Lithuanian.
A little farther north.
A little farther north, right? Like, the, you know, if she reaches in the pocket and finds, you know, and so now you're like, oh, you know, that, again, I don't know. I mean, these are the first two chapters, and it's hard to, you know, figure out the whole book from two chapters. But, but I mean, again, that's the part that matters.
Yeah.
Everything has to do work, I think, would be the way I would, would say it. You don't want to waste words that aren't going to add to the story and do work and move the story forward. In this part is the critical part. The beginning hook for a society in the society genre maps out to the beginning, should map out the world and put the clues in that are going to be used in the middle build and ending payoff.
Yeah. And so I just wanted to underline one more thing about shoe leather is, you know, of course we want to root it out for later drafts, but there's no beating yourself up for having it in your story, right? As you mentioned, Jari, it's necessary, and it's a necessary part of finding the story. And
Absolutely.
Until you get that down, you don't know what is shoe leather. I mean, some stuff you can probably tell, but you don't know for sure what is or what isn't. And so you don't try to edit it out before you finish that first draft, certainly. And you don't beat yourself up because you've got some or even a lot, you know, once you go through it. So I do not give you permission to beat yourself up about it.
Yes. Yeah. Please don't. It's really important in a first draft and even in a second draft that's there. It reminds you of what the story's about. And it's, again, it's like, I don't know, you know, you build anything, you have a rough part of it, and then you start to sand it, or like a table or a, you know, a piece of art or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you never go straight to the final piece. You can't, because you don't know what it's going to be yet. You're creating, and creation is a lot like that. So it's part of the process.
Yes. Okay, well, I have an editorial mission for everyone, and I'm calling it Seeking Shoe Leather. So if you are in the revision phase of your work in progress, then select a scene, and I want you to grab one from the beginning, one from the middle, and one from the end of your story, and save a fresh copy of them because you're going to work with them. And I want you to read them aloud. And then as you're reading them, you know, identify those passages of shoe leather, right? Description, backstory, action, dialogue, maybe even the whole scene, right? Doesn't move the story along. And I want you to read closely and be really ruthless in this. It's, you know, it's time you've put away the creator hat and now you're judging your work. And so just pretend you're a different person, not just wearing a different hat. If there isn't a good reason to include the information, like, for example, you are planting a seed for something that comes later, or it reveals character, or, you know, the best case scenario is that everything is doing at least two things, serving two purposes, then you want to cut it out. So I want you to, after you've gone through that process, then you set those scenes aside and then come back in a day or two or however long to get a fresh perspective and reread those scenes where you've cut the shoe leather, and how does it, how do they feel? How does it compare? And then look at those scenes in light of what I've called the distillate, or you can call it, you know, the log line. It's essentially your story boiled down to, you know, its essence. And I have there's a post that I wrote on how to do that. So if you're not sure on how to like boil down your whole big story into a very small description, then there's a link in the show notes to help you do that. So you can look at your scenes in light of that, or if you have some familiarity with the Story Grid method and the Foolscap Global Story Grid, then that's a great comparison too. That's a one page document that includes the essence of your story, and it has some special details that will help you. So, and I've got a link to how to do that as well, a Story Grid post. So essentially, you want to evaluate the scenes that you've cut things out of. You want to evaluate them in light of, you know, in through the filter of your story without having to reread the whole thing. That's the whole point of that part of it. So then you revise accordingly and then reincorporate those scenes into your current draft. And again, don't try this until you have a complete draft. But once you do, then be ruthless. Go after that shoe leather. So you can, of course, grab the editorial missions in the show notes at writership.com/episodes, and you can sign up to have those delivered right to your inbox in the same location.
Remember, the podcast is sponsored by Jim Kukral from the Author Marketing Club. Jim just launched his new service for authors called Happy Book Reviews. We all know that books with more high-quality reviews sell more copies. HappyBookReviews.com is a service where Jim hopes to make your book happy with reviews. Check out the options at www.HappyBookReviews.com, because nobody likes a sad book. You can make your book happy with reviews.
I just love that I have this image of books, you know, actually smiling and celebrating.
I love book reviews, especially when they're great.
Yes. Okay. And Jim Kukral and the Author Marketing Club, we are so grateful that they cover hosting and technical support for the show. But our Patreon crew supports our time in preparing for the show. We have, as I've mentioned, a new reward for the quartermaster's level, and it's the Writership Podcast Book Club. Of course, it's not just any book club. We review a story and analyze it the way I would for a story grid diagnostic. This month, we're actually reading 4 short stories from the Best Science Fiction and Fantasy of the Year, Volume 10. So if you want to find out more about that, you can visit patreon.com/writership. Of course, there are other ways to support the show as well. You can leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher, or tell a writing friend about us. If you want to have your 5 pages reviewed, please visit writership.com/submissions. That's it for episode 117. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.